Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Today is January the 2nd, 2008. I will not be preaching any messages telling you that this is the beginning of the year when God is going to do everything you ever wanted Him to do, because 8 is the number of new beginnings in the Bible. You're not going to hear me tell you that 2007 and 7 is the number of completion, and therefore last year completed everything that you were supposed to do or that God was going to do, and now it's all new beginnings, because these messages are actually permeating the airwaves right now. So if you want to hear that kind of message, TBN's chock full of it right now. So have at it, but you won't be hearing any of that. At least not here. Okay, I figured you had to go. Now, let's think about that for just a minute, because I really can't turn on the TV, the radio, anything right now without the whole 2008 subject being the material and heading for sermons galore. But we live on what is basically the Julian Gregorian calendar that was based on an assumption about the date that Jesus was born. Some of you may know, those of you that have been studying Latin, that we make a division in our calendar between BC and AD. BC, we typically say, stands for before Christ. Do we know what AD stands for? Anno Domini, right. Which means year of the Lord. And so the assumption is that Jesus was born somewhere around what we call 1 AD. But now that we have computer models of the galaxy that we can turn backwards and take a look at, when Pope Gregory determined the date of Christ's birth, he was basing it off of an eclipse that was written about that happened during Herod's reign. And then they took a good guess at when they thought that eclipse would have happened and started the calendar there. Now we know that he missed from somewhere between 2 to 4 years, which means even though we're calling this numerically 2008, in God's economy, that 8 means nothing, because we've already missed by a couple of years anyway. But not even the whole planet works on the Gregorian calendar that we're holding to. Certainly the Chinese don't care about that. And in the Bible, as we saw last week, when God delivered the children of Israel from Egypt, 2 weeks ago, God delivered the children of Israel from Egypt and said, now this month will be the beginning of months for you. And it was the spring. And so he said that the month of Abib, the month of Nisan, was going to be the first month. So by Jewish reckoning, which is as close as we can get to God actually saying, okay, now when you're doing your date counting, start here. By Jewish reckoning, this is several months away from New Year's. And of course, they're counting from the reckoning they've done back to what they think was the fall and the Garden of Eden. So everybody's working with completely different numeric schemes, and people are dealing with different times when the year began. Some people are on lunar calendars, some are on solar calendars. It is only these egocentric European church folk who have got it in their silly little heads that God is up there in heaven going, oh my goodness, the creatures have determined that this is the year of new beginnings. I'd better get busy. Nowhere else in the world is anybody thinking that way, that their calendar dominates the activity of God. But we can sure turn on the radio and the TV right now and hear just all these silly Christian messages about 2008. So one more time, Jim the Killjoy is going to point out one more time that these are just silly traditions. I understand it. I understand the sentimentality of it. We're time-bound creatures. We like to mark time. We feel our lives and the passing of our lives by how we mark time, the birth dates of our children, how we count our ages. That's all fine. I get it. But don't try to impose on God time-bound requirements that have absolutely nothing to do with Him. So there won't be any of that tonight, and I'm not going to promise you that every great desire of your heart you've ever had is going to be fulfilled in 2008, because God loves eights. That's just not going to happen. We are in Exodus 12. I'm going to spend as much time as it takes. This may take 2 Wednesdays. It may take 3 Wednesdays. It may take till Jesus comes. We're not sure. But I'm going to take as much time as it takes to just talk about Passover now for a while. Because 2 weeks ago, we hit Passover. But that event becomes so central to Israelite history and to the Old Testament and to the reckoning of time among the Israelites. And it's fundamental to how God establishes his covenants with Israel. And then, of course, it has profound New Testament, New Covenant effects and implications. And we'll probably work our way all the way even into the Corinthian letter and continue talking about why we do communion the way we do, which we kind of touched on a couple weeks ago. You had said, oh, this makes sense now. And I want to put it in the largest context because this is one of those few times in human history when God points to a day, an event, a mark on a calendar, and says, now do this perpetually. Do this continually. But then he says that to particular people, and then he marks time by Passovers. And one of the ways that we know, for instance, that Jesus' ministry was 3.5 years. 3.5 almost exactly if, in fact, he was born in the fall, since we know that he died on Passover, which is in the spring. If his birth was in the fall, as I contend, and since we know, according to John, that Jesus was baptized and his ministry began, John says, when he was about 30 years old. So it was right by his birthday there. So his baptism would have been sometime in the fall. His ministry officially began. And then in the Gospels, you can count Passovers. And when you get to the fourth of those in a row that are mentioned and different events surrounding them, he's on the cross. And so by counting that succession of Passovers, we know that his ministry was 3 years, and I would argue 3.5. So I'm going to take as much time as it takes, and we're going to just kind of do big, broad, sweeping portions of the Bible. And I'm going to, obviously, pass over a lot of passages. Pass over, no pun intended. I'm going to skip over several passages that have to do with the Passover in the Old Testament, where it just simply says that Israel stopped and kept it, and it's just a mark in time. But I want to talk about some of the most significant references to Passover in the Old and New Testament because it's so significant in the thinking and the writing of the authors that this just seems like a good juncture to connect all those dots. And you know I'm a big one for dot connecting. It's a skill. It's an art. So let's start in Exodus 12, verse 37. The Passover has taken place. Everyone was told within Israel to go into their house, take up a lamb, keep it in their house for a few days, gather the family, kill the lamb, gather the blood, take the blood, put it on the doorpost, put it on the lintel of the door. God told Israel that if they did that, that when the death angel came through Egypt, he would pass over any house that had the blood on it. And that's where the name Passover comes from. Because the death angel, rather than come in that house or cause any death in that house, would simply pass over. And so God called it his Passover. And he said, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Which we even sing. When I see the blood, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. That's where that's all coming from. The interesting phenomenon here again, as with so many of the plagues that God brought against Egypt, is that on the night that the death was coming to Egypt, God didn't bother to tell the Egyptians how to avoid it. Didn't tell any Egyptians anything about blood. Didn't tell them anything about substitutionary atonement. Didn't tell them any way to have their sins covered or to avoid the judgment of God. But he told all the Israelites through Moses, his mediator, and only told the Israelites because he had already deemed them his people. And so again, we see a very consistent God working in a very consistent way, which is that God has people, they become his people because he chooses them to be his people, and then he tells them how to avoid his judgment. And he doesn't tell anybody else. On the night that the death angel passed through Egypt, death came to every household in Egypt. Seems harsh, seems mean, seems cruel, but Moses takes the time to say, from the household of Pharaoh all the way down to a slave girl, that no one was going to be able to avoid it. The firstborn was going to die. That seems harsh. But when we think about God, when we construct our theology, when we build our thinking about the God of the Bible, the one who never changes, the one who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, the one with whom there is no variableness, neither shadow of turning, we have to recognize that this is one aspect of the real God of the Bible, which is that he is not afraid to pour out judgment where judgment is due. He's perfectly willing to judge people. But he's also very gracious in that he will tell some people how to avoid the judgment. And on what basis does he choose who to tell? Those that are his. So when we get to the New Testament, we talk about, well, those that God chooses, he tells how to avoid the judgment because he gives them the Holy Spirit and they believe in Christ and they'll avoid his judgment. That's not new theology. That is standard biblical, as long as there's been a God, this is how he's worked theology. So all that having happened, verse 37 says, now the sons of Israel journeyed from Ramses to Succoth, about 600,000 men on foot, aside from children. And if there were 600,000 men and children, we assume there were also women in there somewhere. That would explain the children. So if there were as many women as there were men, you're now up to 1,200,000 plus kids. And if each of those couples had a kid or two, you can very quickly see that the number we're talking here is a staggering number of people. We're talking somewhere in that 1.5 to 2 million people that Moses mobilized in one night out of all the land of Egypt. You can see why later, when they want to pass through certain territories, there are kings and armies that go, no, because you'll eat everything and drink up all the water and your animals will eat all the grass. I mean, they were an enormous company of people. And verse 38 says, and this is important, that a mixed multitude also went up with them. The mixed multitude would be non-Israelites, Egyptians or other foreigners that were in slavery, and as long as the slaves were all leaving, they just kind of joined the party. Hey, we're leaving, and off they went. So they had strangers and foreigners with them as they were leaving. So God, when he lays down the Passover rules, has to account for, well, what about these strangers and foreigners and the mixed multitude? So he's going to lay out Passover rules. Along with flocks and herds, and a very large number of livestock. They baked the dough, which they had brought out of Egypt, into cakes of unleavened bread, for it had not become leavened, since they were driven out of Egypt and could not delay, nor had they prepared any provisions for themselves. Now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, and it came about at the end of 430 years to the very day that all the hosts of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. I pointed out 2 weeks ago that since Moses says to the very day, that means the reckoning and the counting of the 430 years also started on Passover, also started on the very day that God brought them out. So this Passover day, this 14th of Nisan, this full moon in the middle of that month, God had already started counting that 430 years before he even revealed it to them, because he began the reckoning on that day. So it's a very, very important day, very important observance. Verse 42, it is a night. Remember again, I got to give it perspective again. Remember that Moses is writing the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, from the perspective of having already lived it, having already been to Sinai, having already had the opportunity to sit down and write, so sometimes he'll stop his narrative and he'll just lay out instruction because he already has the insight of the years that have intervened. So he goes from the narrative to saying in verse 42, it is a night to be observed, it is for the Lord, for having brought Israel out of the land of Egypt, this night is for the Lord to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generations. So let's start with the easy questions. When are they supposed to stop doing it?
Never.
As long as there's an Israel, they're supposed to keep doing it. And according to Jeremiah, Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 31 that as long as the sun and the moon and the stars are in their ordinances, as long as there are still waves in the ocean, Israel will continue to be a nation before the Lord. So if you walk outside and there's a sun, if you go to the ocean and you can still surf, then you know for sure that by God's reckoning, Israel is still a nation before him, and therefore Israel should still be keeping the Passover, right? Second question, another obvious one. Who is supposed to keep the Passover?
Israelites.
Were the Australians doing a lot of Passover keeping at this moment? South Americans? Eskimos? A lot of Eskimos out there keeping the Passover? Egyptians? Any Egyptians keeping the Passover? No, this is a covenant that God made with a particular people and then said, now because I've delivered you, proving that you are my people, proving that you are the descendants of Abraham, proving that you are the ones that I chose and that I'm keeping promises to based on my own faithfulness, because I'm that God, every year at this time, you stop and remember that I did this. But he didn't require any other people group to do it. And so for the next 1,400 years, which is roughly the time between the Exodus and the advent of Christ, for that time period, the Israelites, every year, would stop and observe this. And they would remember, and they would remember, and they would remember. This night is for the Lord to be observed by all the sons of Israel throughout their generations. And the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover. No foreigner is to eat of it. There he's made a distinction again. Now they've got this mixed multitude. They've got these foreigners traveling with them. Even with the foreigners that were in the mixed multitude that was traveling with the Israelites, God did not require the foreigners to keep the Passover because they were not, importantly, the descendants of Abraham. The descendants of Abraham were the people who were going back to the promised land because it was Abraham who had the promise. Right? So let's say that there was an Ishmaelite in there with them. The Ishmaelites were basically the Arab folk. Naturally, they would have traveled down into Egypt, would have blended in pretty well. What if some of them had become enslaved and now had fallen in with their cousins, the Israelites, and they're traveling out of Egypt, out into the desert with the Israelites at this moment? Was God expecting them to keep the Passover? No, because they're not the seed. And this is one of those places, again, where seedology is so important. Abraham gave promises to the seed. And he said, in Isaac shall your seed be called. So descendants of Isaac constituted the seed. But the descendants of Ishmael? No. And then we follow down the generations from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. Jacob had a twin brother. Was his twin brother counted for the seed? No, the descendants of Jacob. And so the Israelites from that point forward were known as the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because that's tracing the particular lineage, the particular seed that are the promised group of people. And if you're not in that group, if you're not in that heritage, then you're a foreigner, you're a stranger. And you're not the one that God has his eye on as he's bringing this group back to Canaan. Because God is, here's my whole point, particular. Always has been, always will be. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I was just going to ask, the language there doesn't really mean just that they're excluded from it, but that they're not allowed at all.
Yeah. Don't eat it. Don't be part of it. Not in it. No, no. No foreigner is to eat of it. but every man's slave purchased with money, after you have circumcised him, he may eat of it. That's interesting language. If they are determined to be God-fearers, if they are going to follow after the religion of the Jews, then they have to start with circumcision. And if they do that, then they can partake of the Passover with you. But that's because they're converting to the religion and the worship of Jehovah. So he says, every man's slave purchased with money, after you have circumcised him, he may eat of it. A sojourner, however, and somebody just traveling with you, somebody from the mixed multitude traveling with you because you're a large group of people and you've got food and animals, a sojourner or a hired servant, not somebody you've bought and that you own, he may not eat of it. It is to be eaten in a single house. In other words, once you sit down to eat it, you have to eat all of it right then and there. You don't get up and take any of it with you. It's not to be used for a picnic. No sandwiches the next day. You have to eat it in the house that night. You are not to bring forth any of the flesh outside of the house, nor are you to break any bone of it. Now, for 1,400 years, they're busy making sure that their Passover lamb, once they've bled it out, once they've cooked it, and they've sat down to eat it, and whatever's not eaten, they burn the rest of it so that it's not taken out of the house. One thing they're very particular and careful to do is that they don't break a bone of it. And they don't know why for all those years. And then when Jesus hangs on the cross and all the typology is being fulfilled in Christ on the cross, you may recall that when they came to Pilate to beg the body of Jesus down off the cross because the high day was coming, and they were surprised to hear that he was already dead, because crucifixion would oftentimes take several days. And here he was already dead. Well, if they needed someone to die quickly, they would break their legs, because the only way that a crucified person could get a breath, which is a lot of the reason that they would nail their feet together, and sometimes there'd be a little, like a wedge under their feet, the pressure, concave pressure on your lungs, would cause you to suffocate, which is the way that most crucified folks died, whether it was this way or this way. And so you'd push up from your legs just to be able to get a little bit of breath and back down. So they would come out and break your legs, and then you would suffocate hanging there. So you may recall that the soldiers came out with the intention of breaking Jesus' legs, and they were surprised to find that he was already dead, and so they pierced his side, again in perfect keeping with all of the Old Testament prophecies, saying that not a bone of him would be broken, and that blood and water would pour out of him. And so even these Roman soldiers fulfilled prophecy, but God prophesied it 1,400 years in advance, in that the animal that they were going to use for their Passover couldn't have any broken legs, couldn't have any broken bones, any less legs. Verse 47, all the congregation of Israel are to celebrate and observe this. So who is it that's supposed to observe this? All the congregation of Israel. So only Israel, but all of Israel. Everybody God chooses is supposed to keep doing it. But nobody who doesn't fall under that Abrahamic covenant, nobody else is supposed to do it. And they're specifically told not to. Don't you all do it. Don't you all try to participate in this, because you're not covered by this. This group is covered by it, and therefore all of them are to participate in it. God's very, very particular, but in his particularity, he's also very, very complete. Not a one that he chooses is going to be left out. All the congregation of Israel are to celebrate this. By the way, that's also significant because, see if I can get every nuance in here. There are some things when they get to Sinai that God is going to say, you Israelites, you individuals, you people, you can't do this. Like the tabernacle in the wilderness. You can't come in here. This is a holy place. It's walled off. You common folks don't come in here. You need a priest. You need an intercessor. You need a Levite. You need somebody to do it for you. You can bring your sacrifice, but you can't sacrifice it. once a year, only the high priest can go into the holiest place, the Holy of Holies. And he's got to have the right clothes on and the right blood and the right incense and the right sacrifice. He's got to be wearing the right clothes. He's got to have on the right turban. He's got to have the bells around his feet, and he better have a rope around his ankle. And he's going to go in and sacrifice. So later God is going to be particular and say, now there's some things that you all just can't do. And the thing that you can't do is sacrifice for yourself. Isn't that interesting? The thing you cannot do as an individual before God is go atone for your own sinfulness. You can't do it. You have to have a mediator. You have to have a priest. You have to have somebody God chose. He chose Aaron and Aaron's descendants, Aaron's lineage, and said, nobody else gets to be high priest, and nobody else better come in here. I'll kill you. And you better do it exactly the way I tell you to do it. Don't do it my way. I'll kill you. Because human beings, while they can commemorate God, while they can praise and worship God, the one thing they cannot do is sacrifice to God sufficient to cover their own sin. And that's been preached continually. So it's interesting here that he says, all the congregation should do this one. This is one of those you can all do. You all celebrate it. You all observe it. And in fact, when I take you into the promised land, I'm going to gather you together in Jerusalem every year just to observe and celebrate this. And God wants it to be a time of happiness and worship and joy in commemorating what he did. Verse 48. But if a stranger sojourns with you and celebrates the Passover to the Lord, then let all his males be circumcised, and then let him come near to celebrate it. And he shall be like a native in the land, but no uncircumcised person may eat of it. The same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you. That law is circumcision. The mark of the Abrahamic covenant is an absolute requirement to participate in the Passover. So no mark of Abraham, no worship of Yahweh, don't participate in this. God's so serious about it that he's going to threaten sickness, death, that sort of thing. Now hang on to that reality, because at some point in the next couple weeks, we're going to end up in the Corinthian letters, and Paul's going to be writing to the Corinthian church and telling them that when they celebrate, when they misuse, when they abuse the way the Passover is supposed to be kept, he says, you eat and drink damnation to yourself. And then he says, and some of you are sick, and some of you are dead because of how you have abused this memorial. So the very consistent God, all the way back here 1,400 years before Christ, even after Christ, continued to say, I take this really seriously, so make sure that you observe it appropriately. You got the big picture? Okay. So that takes us to verse 49. The same law shall apply to the native as to the stranger who sojourns among you. Then all the sons of Israel did so. They did just as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. And it came about on that same day that the Lord brought the sons of Israel out of the land of Egypt by their hosts. So we'll start in chapter 13 when we get back to this portion of Exodus. So somebody make a mark and remind me that we're going back to Exodus 13 whenever we get done talking about Passover. Turn to Exodus 34 real quick now. Exodus 34, verse 13. This jumps forward a little bit in the Exodus story because God is now telling them, when I take you into the promised land, I want you every year to keep this Passover thing. And he starts laying out feasts. God starts setting times. He starts setting particular times of the year and saying, at this time of year, I expect you to come be here to worship me. We can't start at verse 13. That makes no sense at all. If you worship other gods, let's make a covenant. Let's start at verse 17. Okay, this should sound familiar. You will not make for yourself any molten gods. You shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For 7 days, You are to eat unleavened bread, as I commanded you, at the appointed time, in the month of Abib, for in the month of Abib you came out of Egypt. The first offspring from every womb belongs to me, and all your male livestock, the first offspring from your cattle and your sheep. The point is that God is saying, okay, now, I didn't kill all your firstborn when I killed all the Egyptian firstborn. Therefore, they all belong to me. They're all mine now. They're consecrated to me. But then he says, but if you want to keep them, you can redeem them. Verse 20, and you shall redeem with a lamb the first offspring from a donkey. And if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. You shall redeem all the firstborn of your sons, and none shall appear before me empty-handed. You will work 6 days, but on the seventh day you shall rest. Even during plowing time and harvest time you will rest. And you shall celebrate the Feast of Weeks. We know that is Pentecost. That is the first fruits of the wheat harvest and the Feast of Ingathering at the turn of the year. Verse 23, three times a year all your males are to appear before the Lord God, the God of Israel. For I will drive out nations before you and enlarge your borders, and no man shall covet your land when you go up three times a year to appear before the Lord your God. Isn't that interesting? That's even got some divine protection built into it. Because he said, now three times a year, from wherever you are in Canaan land, once I give it to you, all the males that can travel are required to come to Jerusalem to appear before me three times a year. Well, the natural thinking then would be, well, if all the males are out of the land, aren't we going to get ransacked? Aren't our enemies going to come in and take over the land? We're going to come worship you, God, and then we're going to come back and find out we're inhabited by foreigners. What about that? And God says very clearly that that won't happen. He'll protect your land while you come and worship him. Then he says, I will drive out nations before you, verse 24. I'll enlarge your borders. No man shall covet your land when you go up three times a year to appear before the Lord your God. And you shall not offer the blood of my sacrifice with leavened bread. Nor is the sacrifice of the feast of the Passover to be left over until morning. You shall bring the very first of your first fruits of your soil into the house of the Lord your God, and you shall not boil a kid in its mother's milk. Write down these words, the Lord said to Moses, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and with Israel. So here we go again. God keeps saying, I'm making a covenant with Israel. I am establishing my covenant with Israel. And these are the marks of the covenant I'm establishing with Israel. And one of those marks is, every seventh day, you're going to rest. Now, does that mean that everybody in the whole world is supposed to rest on the seventh day everywhere? No, we're not in that covenant. Gentiles, Australians, Eskimos, nobody resting on the seventh day. Because they were never told to. But in establishing his covenant with Israel, he said, rest every seventh day. Don't do any servile work. Doesn't matter if it's the harvest, whatever's going on, you're going to rest that day. And then he says, you're going to keep these feasts three times a year. You're going to come up and be before me. And you're going to come on Pentecost, and you're going to come in the fall, and you're going to come in the spring for the Passover and the unleavened bread. And this is my covenant with you. So he was so serious about this whole Passover thing, then he made sure to say, your very relationship with me, the covenant I have established with you, is dependent on you making sure to come see me three times a year. The Passover's that important. You getting a feeling for it? God did not just deliver them on the 14th of Abib and then say, you know what, it'd be nice if you remembered that. If you skip a year, whatever. Instead, he said, this is really important, so much so that he built it into the structure of the Sinai law. When he gives them the law, he says, you must do it. It's not optional. So go to the book of Leviticus real quick. The book of Leviticus, Leviticus 23, you can see right in the word Leviticus that it has the word Levite in it. The book of Leviticus is the law that was given to the Levites to then teach all of Israel. And we may very well, when we get done with Genesis and Exodus, we may go on into Leviticus. So we're in Leviticus here. We're in Leviticus 23. Reading in the law, we're going to start at verse 1. We'll just read the first 8 verses for the moment. The Lord spoke again to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel." So who's the target audience?
Sons of Israel.
It's becoming really easy now, isn't it? "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, 'The Lord's appointed times, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, my appointed times are these.'" Number one, "For 6 days work may be done, but on the 7th day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwellings." So number one, of the rules that God gave Israel and called it an appointed time, is that every 7th day, every Saturday on our calendar, there'd be no work, complete cessation of any work. Verse 4 then, "These are the appointed times of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the times appointed for them. In the first month," what is the first month now?
Nisan
or Abib, either one of those. "In the first month, on the 14th day of the month at twilight," which makes it the night of the 13th, "is the Lord's Passover." So it's right up there with Sabbath. We understand that among Israel, keeping Sabbath, the seventh day Sabbath, is a mark of the covenant that God made with Israel in particular at Mount Sinai. But right up there next to it is keep Passover. On a particular date, at a particular time, observe the Passover. Then on the 15th day of the same month, there is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. "For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day of those 7, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. But for 7 days, you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord, and on the 7th day is a holy convocation, and you shall not do any laborious work." And then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, 'When you enter the land which I am going to give you, and you reap its harvest, then you shall bring in the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest, and he will wave the sheaf before the Lord for you to be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it.'" So essentially the picture is this. I know I've described this before. I'm going to keep describing it until you've got it drilled into your head, because it's so important when you get into the New Testament. This is where so many mistakes get made, because people just don't have a full enough, firm enough, established concept of the Old Testament rules that the first century Jewish believers were abiding by, the feasts they were keeping, and how that all ties in with Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. So on the 14th day at evening, which is the evening of the 13th, the ending of the 13th, the beginning of the 14th, because they're on a lunar calendar, their day starts at sundown, not at midnight. So on the evening of the 14th, which is the end of the 13th, is the Passover. The next evening is the beginning of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But that first day is a high holy day. That's so important because in John's gospel, he takes the time to point that exact thing out, which every Jew, every Israelite would understand, that if Jesus died on Passover, the next day is a Sabbath day. They all would know that. It's a high day. It's a holy day. It's a Sabbath day. It's what we just read. The Levitical law says the 15th of Nisan every year is a high day. That is why Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus were in such a hurry to get Jesus' body down off the cross, because they couldn't do any work the next day because it was a high day. So they had to be in their homes and they couldn't go anywhere, and the body is outside the wall and it's more likely to be stolen, eaten by dogs, eaten by birds, whatever else that's going to happen to mutilate that body, and that body can't get mutilated. So that's why they're in such a hurry that they go to Pilate begging for the body, and Pilate can't believe that he's already dead, and so they send the Roman soldiers out. And they're going to break his legs to make sure he's dead. They're surprised to find him dead. They pierce his side. The blood flows. They get him off there. The reason that he ended up in Joseph of Arimathea's tomb is that it says that tomb was close by, and it had no body in it yet, because it belonged to Joseph. So they're just in a hurry to get to a close tomb and get his body in there because the next day is a high day. So folks get confused and say, well then, if the day that was beginning is a Sabbath day, well then Jesus was dead or put on a tomb on a Friday. And all the Friday thinking and theology grows out of that. But there's absolutely no requirement that it be a Friday. The only requirement is that it be a high day, which is always the 15th of the month. You understand that? Then what we just read in the Levitical law is the first day and the seventh day of that week-long feast of unleavened bread, in the middle of that week somewhere, there's going to be a first fruit day. There's going to be a first day of the week. So if the 15th happens to fall on a Tuesday, so that's a high day, and then the following Tuesday is a high day, somewhere in there, there's a Sunday. If you go Friday to Friday, if you go Saturday to Saturday, somewhere in there, there's a Sunday. And wherever that Sunday falls, that first day of the week, that's the Feast of First Fruit, when you bring the first fruit of all the good of your land that God has given you, and you bring that to God. And that is why all of the New Testament writers and all of the Gospel writers don't hesitate to point out that he raised on the first day of the week. That was really important for them to point out because it was the fulfillment of the first fruit. And so Paul would call him the first fruit of the resurrection. They all point out what day of the week it was that he rose, but they don't point out what day of the week it was that he died because they feel that's already established in the fact that it's 3 days and three nights. And so you do the counting backwards and you're going to end up in the right place. Understand? That's why this stuff in Leviticus is just so important. If it is true that Jesus fulfilled all of the types and shadows that are built into these feasts, then it's absolutely necessary that he die on Passover, be in the grave on the beginning of unleavened bread, and that he raise on first fruit, and that 50 days later on Pentecost, the Spirit falls and the church is born. And wouldn't you know that that's exactly what we see the New Testament writers arguing? But if you don't have all that Old Testament foundation, you miss it, and you end up arguing for Friday. Friday night to Sunday morning, 3 days, three nights, because Christians can't do math. I don't get that at all. So do you understand the Leviticus rules here? These are absolute built-in rules, and they're not just suggestions. They're part of the law. They're absolute requirements that for 1,400 years they have to do. You can read about the Passover in Numbers 9, Numbers 28, Numbers 33. The book of Numbers has plenty to say about the fact that Israel kept the Passover. But go over to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is another one of those books full of rules and laws. Go to Deuteronomy 16. I had a conversation with Elder Ward many years ago. And we were talking about Israel, future for Israel. I don't remember all the details, but the point was, in talking about it, I had said to Elder Ward, who was sitting back smoking his pipe, I said, how many times? Because he said, so you see a future for Israel? And I said, you know, kind of duh, yeah. And I said, how many times does God have to say something for it to be true? And he tamped down his pipe very calmly, and then he just kind of leaned in and looked me in the eye, and he said, only once. But we see this Passover thing over and over and over again. God just keeps saying it through the history of Israel. Passover, Passover, Passover. It's one of the most consistent themes in the Old Testament. Passover, keep doing it, remember it, teach it to the next generation, tell your children about it. Don't forget the Passover. And so you need to feel that pressure. You need to feel that importance of the Passover when you get to Jesus observing the Passover, because of course he would. He was born under the law. Of course, he, as our perfect substitute, is going to fulfill and keep the Passover for us, and then even be our Passover for us. So chapter 16 of the book of Deuteronomy, more rules, more laws. Observe, starting in verse 1, observe the month of Abib to celebrate the Passover to the Lord your God. For in the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. And you shall sacrifice the Passover to the Lord your God from the flock and the herd in the place where the Lord chooses to establish his name. You shall not eat leavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat with it unleavened bread, the bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, in order that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. Now we understand what Passover's for. The purpose of keeping this feast every year and everybody traveling that can travel, and God saying, when you get to Canaan land, I'm going to establish a place where my name is. I'm going to put my name there. Well, it turns out to be Jerusalem. And so he's going to say, 3 times a year, you've got to come to Jerusalem, come stand before me. And the purpose of the Passover is so that you remember year by year, generation by generation, that on this night I delivered you out. And look at the language. The language is so important. In order that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. You're going to remember my deliverance. So now I'm going to jump forward, and we'll get to it in a week or two. So now Jesus sits down to keep the Passover. And his disciples, all Jews, sitting around the table with him, would have naturally understood the purpose for the Passover. The purpose of the Passover is to remember the deliverance from Egypt. That's what they sat down there to do. And they've got their unleavened bread. And they've got their bitter herbs. They've got their Passover lamb. They've got all, they're sitting there, they've got their whole meal, and it's all prepared in advance. Jesus said it'll be all prepared in an upper room when you go in the city. And they go in and they sit down to keep the Passover meal. And what's the conversation going to be about? Remember Egypt. Remember the deliverance. Remember the night that God brought us out? He's eating it at night because the 14th of Nisan has just begun. We know that all the other stuff that happens over the course of the night, and the next day is when he's on the cross. So that evening, he's sitting down to eat the Passover, and they would have known after 1,400 years of having it drilled into their collective conscience, they would have known we're remembering the deliverance from Egypt, and Jesus says something absolutely startling. It says, this bread. What bread? The unleavened bread. We've been reading all this. The unleavened bread. Don't eat bread with any leaven. Get all the leaven out of your household. Only eat unleavened bread. And he picks up that bread and he breaks that bread, that unleavened bread. 1,400 years they've been doing it. And he says, this is my body. Surprise. And he says, this is my body, given for you. Do this in remembrance, same language, remembrance. They're all going, yeah, in remembrance of Egypt, right? And he says, do this in remembrance of me. He didn't say stop doing it. You're Israelites. You're going to keep doing it. Of course you're going to do it. Through all your generations, you're going to do it. But now, because I am the new lawgiver, now because I am the one Moses spoke of, the better, higher lawgiver, with the better, higher promises, with the better, higher covenant, I'm not going to say stop doing it. I'm just going to change your focus. And now when you do it, remember me. And then he picks up the cup and he says, this is the cup of the blood of the
new covenant.
Brand new covenant. So what does he do on Passover? He says, okay, remember how Passover started? It started with a covenant God made with you Israelites. And God established it as a covenant and said, you must do this as a covenant. But now I'm going to take these symbols and I'm going to take these emblems, and they now testify to the new covenant in my blood. So when I go to the cross, you are no longer under that old covenant. You are now under the new covenant. Now keep doing it, But now change your focus. Now instead of doing what Deuteronomy says and remembering the deliverance from Egypt, do what I say. Does that sound familiar? That's like the Sermon on the Mount. Him saying, now you've heard it said, but I say unto you. He walked around with that sense of authority that he superseded the law. He superseded the old covenant. He had the right to say, you've heard this said, but now I say. And sometimes he raised the level of what he said. Sometimes he said the exact opposite of what the law said. But he expected that everyone would understand that what he said was superior to what the law said. And the law covenant said, remember Egypt. And he said, remember me. Because there was a change, there was a transition, there was a cataclysmic change in the way God was dealing with his people, specifically his people. He was no longer going to be dealing with them by the law, by the rules, by all the stuff they couldn't keep, by all the laws that could only condemn. Now there was a new covenant in the blood of Christ, the covenant of salvation by grace through faith in his finished work, and he established it on Passover. That same day that God picked out 430 years before, when he started the whole process, was the same day that Jesus freed us from our slavery. Yes, sir.
In the Passover, as it was originally given, it was really as much a remembrance of the God who delivered them as it was the deliverance itself, right? And so now Jesus is saying, in place of remembering Yahweh, remember me. That's a putting himself on an equal par with God, isn't it?
Absolutely. Very consistent with everything else he did in his ministry where he made himself equal with God.
And also with the previous covenant, it was God who declared, announced, and gave that and instituted it.
Right.
And now we have Jesus again on par with God, declaring, announcing, giving, and instituting this new covenant.
Right.
Yeah, those are amazing things to ponder.
At Sinai, when God dispensed his will and said, okay, I've delivered you. Now here are all my rules. Did they have any options? They have any choices? No. So when Jesus comes along and says, okay, here's my covenant, does he leave any choice in there to anybody? No, same consistent God saying, I'm just simply going to dispense my will among my people. And aren't you glad that you were born under the newer, higher, better covenant that actually perfects completely instead of that old covenant that never was able to perfect anyone? But yeah, those are very good points. I mean, it is Jesus acting like God, being God.
Now, the other thing I'm trying to think through, and this is where my mind was stuck a moment ago and trying to gather some thoughts, and I still haven't gathered them, so it's just a question right now, is in this new setting of the new covenant, Jesus is speaking of the bread and the cup as representing himself, his body, and his blood. In the previous Passover, was there anything specific that the bread itself or the drink itself was meant to symbolize?
Yeah, he said the bread was the bread of affliction, remember, a couple minutes ago, to remember their affliction and their slavery. They also were told to eat bitter herbs to remind them of the bitterness of their captivity.
I guess I'm trying to draw some parallels between the previous Passover,
right,
the way Christ referenced those things to himself. Do you see anything there specifically?
The only place when he said, this is my body, is that his body was going to be horribly afflicted. We knew that was coming.
Right.
And certainly Isaiah writing, smitten and afflicted. I mean, our deliverance came from him taking our affliction.
Yes.
So the fact that, you know, for 1,400 years they ate unleavened bread to remind them of their own affliction, it's interesting that he would pick up that bread that they would say, oh, that's to remind us of our affliction. And he would say, this is my body, given for you, afflicted for you.
Mm-hmm.
I as your substitute. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to take on that affliction in your place. Substitutionary atonement, which is what the lamb represented. You know, you're going to bleed out the lamb rather than you dying. And the judgment's going to pass over you if I see the blood of the lamb. Christ becomes our Passover lamb. The sword goes in, or the spear goes in his side. The blood flows. God sees the blood and passes over us. So all of that typology continues to speak the same wonderful gospel of God pouring out the punishment that the law required on Christ instead of us. So,
thank you.
Yeah, no problem.
Does current Christian Easter coincide with today's Jews when they celebrate Passover?
Yes, Easter is typically the Sunday after Passover. They're kind of following that lunar Jewish calendar and wherever Passover. That's why Easter is sort of the only Western holiday we have that moves, yeah. It's like so early spring, late spring, and then it
coincides. We've adjusted to their Jewish calendar for
right.
Easter. So that
right, that so that the Passover, Easter series of events coincide. Yeah. I'm in Deuteronomy 16, verse 3. You shall not eat unleavened bread with it. 7 days you shall eat with it unleavened bread. You will not eat leavened bread with it. Here's the answer to what you had asked. The bread of affliction, for you came out of the land of Egypt in haste, in order that you may remember all the days of your life, the day when you came out of the land of Egypt. For 7 days no leaven shall be seen in all your territory, and none of the flesh which you sacrifice in the evening of the first day shall remain overnight until morning. There it is again, the Passover lamb. None of it can remain till morning. And you're not allowed to sacrifice the Passover in any of your towns, which the Lord your God is going to give you, but at the place where the Lord your God chooses to establish his name, which is going to be Jerusalem. They all have to come to Jerusalem for the Passover. And you shall sacrifice the Passover in the evening at sunset, at the time that you came out of Egypt. And you shall cook and eat it in the place which the Lord your God chooses. And in the morning you are to return to your tents. 6 days you shall eat unleavened bread, and on the seventh day there will be a solemn assembly to the Lord your God. You shall do no work on it, and then you'll count your 7 weeks to yourself. That's the Feast of Weeks. That's what we know as Pentecost. So I think I've made my point. Did everybody follow all of that for this evening? Now, I'm not quite done, because there are more very significant Passover events to come. So next week we're going to pick up in the book of Joshua, where God is going to bring all the Israelites into the land of Canaan that he has promised them and bring them right to the edge of Jericho. And hey, guess what day that just happens to fall on? Passover again. And then God is going to stop after 40 years of giving them manna in the wilderness. Guess what day he stops giving them manna in the wilderness? Passover. And on that Passover, they're facing Jericho, the first war they're going to have to deal with, they think, as they enter into the promised land. Guess who shows up? Jesus. Isn't that interesting? A pre-incarnate master of the armies of heaven stands before Joshua and accepts worship. And remember that rule. Anytime you see any kind of angelic being, they always say, don't worship me. I'm just a servant like you. But instead, the master of all the Lord's armies stands before Joshua, and Joshua says, are you for us or are you for them? And he's really happy to hear that the Lord's armies are on his side. So way before he shows up on planet Earth and eats Passover with his disciples, he shows up on a very significant Passover and brings the Israelites into their promised land. So we'll pick up there, and we'll keep working our way toward the New Testament, and then we're going to read the story of Jesus actually keeping the Passover and that change into the New Covenant, and then we're going to read Paul teaching about that to the Corinthians and how important it is that it's done correctly. So that's where we're going. Those are the coming attractions. Okay, yes.
Uh-huh. But in Deuteronomy, it looks like you changed it up. It was in your home, and now you have to go to Jerusalem.
Yeah, when I take you into the land that I'm going to take you into, okay, and when I tell you where the place is where I put my name, which is going to be Jerusalem, then you have to leave your home and come to that place. Okay. As long as they're in the wilderness traveling for that 40 years, and until they're in the promised land, then yes, they keep it in their homes. But once he establishes Jerusalem, which is where his temple's going to be, then he says all the men who can travel have to come to Jerusalem to keep the feast. And that's really, I think, God just making real obvious that he has chosen a place on the planet where the real God is worshipped among the people he's chosen. And I also think it's so easy for people, because we're people, it's so easy if he says, just keep doing it at home, it'll become secondary, lackluster, we'll miss it this year. But if you have to travel, if you gotta be there, when the harvest happens, you're gonna get that first fruit of the harvest because you know you have to take it to Jerusalem. You're gonna have it in your hands and you're gonna go take it. So does that make sense, that transition?
It does.
Okay. Anything else?
No. He was talking about the male firstborn when we were in Leviticus.
The firstborn male belongs to me, yeah. And that does kind of answer Laurel's question about male female. Is that when he says the firstborn of your animals and your sheep, he was calling for the firstborn males. Yep. And then he does later say, instead of taking all your firstborn males, I'm just going to take the tribe of Levi. All the Levites belong to me, but only the males end up serving him.
Plus, yep. When he includes servants, he does not include women because you have to be circumcised.
So right. Circumcision, strictly male. Yep. Oh, which makes the women kind of go, whew, so that's good.
Is that because women are more precious or less precious?
Tangent.
I'm sorry. I was trying to listen, but there was a ringing in my ear, and I... See how I avoided that one completely? Anything else?
I was wondering about that earlier when the circumcision. Yeah, when it says all of the circumcision, so in what sense is a wife or a child or an unattached woman included in that? Is it just understood that she is?
You know, there are moments in the Old Testament where that becomes an issue. Like there are some women who come to Moses and say, we're the only descendants of our father and there's no male in our family. Do we lose our inheritance? And Moses goes to God with it and God says, no, it's still going to follow through the woman. So.
God does some really remarkable things with women and poor women now, like Rahab. And
oh, absolutely. There are some very, very significant women in the Old Testament. Yeah, I mean, God understands that men and women are part of the group of people he has chosen. He didn't just put Adam in the garden, Adam and Eve, and so even within Israel, he's always been very, for lack of a better word, fair, very equitable with women. And certainly, in the book of Esther, saved the whole nation of Israel through a woman who was willing to say, if I perish, I perish. So there's a strong woman for you. There, that would be a significant woman.
Oh, we're all significant.
I wouldn't say anything else. I know better than to argue that point.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.